Last month, my good friend Greg LaBelle turned another page in an illustrious career as he retired from the position of assistant professor of political management at George Washington University. Greg was smart enough to do this at a young enough age to allow him many, many more chapters still to come. And so, with sincere congratulations on his hard-earned retirement, I'm delighted to welcome Greg LaBelle back to State of Belief Radio. Hello, Greg.
Thanks, Welton. It's nice to talk to you again.
So I realize recent political events have hit you particularly hard, and I share a lot of that. We both have, I fear, an idealized notion of American democracy that is rather hard to see right now.
I think that pretty nicely sums it up, yes, yes. Idealism is something that I think has been given short shrift, certainly in the last few months, and I think those who listened to the president's final address from Chicago last week heard, I think, the best of idealism in this country and the important role that idealism plays in who we are and where we go. And I think there was a clear warning in that speech to us to hold on to our idealism, to our ideals, to who we are in the face of some unique challenges that we all think we'll be facing in the coming months and years.
What were your thoughts as you watched President Obama's farewell speech this week?
Well, emotionally, I don't often post a lot of stuff on Facebook, but I did post the speech, and my comment was not a dry eye in this house. Mm-hmm. Seeing him go is difficult. Would have been anyway, but I think made more difficult when one looks at the results of the election in November. I thought it was one of his best speeches mm-hmm. in that he really did summarize, I think, in ways that only Barack Obama can, considering who he is, where he's from, what he's managed to accomplish in 8 years, the sense of who we are and what's important about the United States, what American exceptionalism means. He, I think, happily redefined that term in a way that makes sense to me. It's not that we see ourselves as perfect, but we see ourselves as having the ability to change for the better. And I think that's the kind of exceptionalism that that we should continue to work for in this country.
Greg, if you were still teaching, what would you have directed students to pay the most attention to around the end of Mr. Obama's presidency?
Well, I think strategically and tactically, I think that the president and the administration have been working hard to do what they can to shore up some of the successes that we've seen by taking some additional executive action, setting aside some additional land for protection for posterity, I think is a perfect example of that. I think that the president continues to use his powers wisely in trying to do that. The other thing I think that's important to acknowledge is that I suppose is second only to Hillary Clinton, the most disappointed person in the results of that election is probably Barack Obama. And his statesmanship, his recognition of his constitutional responsibility to ensure a transition that's smooth and positive, is something that he has taken very seriously, much to his credit. And in his speech, he acknowledged that he was treated the same way by George W. Bush when he was coming into office. Mm-hmm. And that is one of those pieces of American exceptionalism that I think he was talking about. And I think those are two points that I think students need to be aware of in this otherwise era of suspicion and mistrust.
Greg, we're hearing some real negative criticism regarding President Obama over his handling of the Middle East, his handling of Syria. How do you respond to those critics?
The first place to start, I think, is that there, and I think we see this in a number of cases in the incoming administration, as these folks are beginning to talk more about this, as I've watched Tillerson's hearings this week, mm-hmm. And was sort of struck at the, I think, feigned simplicity of these issues. There seems to be an attempt to basically simplify the situation in the Middle East. You know, yeah. As you said, I just retired, which lets you know roughly how old I am. And I remember junior in high school taking a course called Problems of Democracy. And one of the issues we studied was the Middle East. And mm-hmm. I told many friends in the past few years that I could probably, if I still had that book from 1966, I could cross out some of the names and write in new names, and you would be able to use the book as a text in high school today. Some of these issues are so intractable, so difficult. And I think what President Obama has tried to do, and he did a brilliant interview with, I think, Greg Easterbrook, I don't remember exactly, in Atlantic Monthly a few months ago, where he talked about the Middle East and about the challenges and about the importance of changing how we as the United States look at these issues and take a longer range view. So while there have been some successes and a number of failures in the Middle East, I think that what the Obama administration has tried to do is sort of move us into a new way of looking at these issues that I think if we could continue in that direction, I think would have long-term benefits. But these issues are so intractable in the Middle East. As I said, they go back many, many, many years, and it's a very difficult situation. But I think it is important to reassess what our role can and should be in that area and probably most other areas of international affairs.
Greg, when you look around, you read the Washington Post, I know every morning, you think about Obama leaving the office and a new administration moving in. In all seriousness, do you feel like you got out just in time, meaning that the way we look at politics and leadership are fundamentally changing?
You are very perceptive, Welton. I have told friends that while I had planned to retire at the end of last year for some time, I have said that not having to step in front of a class starting next week of students to try somehow to explain politics, not only to explain politics, but to express my deep-seated belief in the value and importance of politics in this country, I am sort of relieved that I don't have to do that because, quite honestly, I'm not sure where I would begin at this point. Maybe in a year I will feel differently, but right now I don't. I will continue to do some teaching at George Washington, and one of the programs that I will be teaching in the spring is a program that we do in Pamplona, Spain. A number of students come and study with us for a few weeks. And I'm actually looking forward to that because getting the opportunity to present this and see this through the eyes of students from Western Europe is going to be really instructive for me. And I think it's going to help me sort of sort some of this out as we proceed through the early months of the new administration. So I guess yes and no.
I'm assuming you watched the president-elect's press conference. Thoughts?
Yes. More of the same. This is the thing that is distressing because this is a guy who gives situation ethics a bad name. it's sort of, if you say something nice about me, you're my best friend. If tomorrow you say something that I don't think is nice about me, you're my worst enemy. This is a dangerous mindset for a president of the United States. I think that this whole issue around the intelligence community, which again became very clear during the press conference, is appalling. To liken the intelligence community of the United States to Nazi Germany by an incoming president, to be openly hostile, and I would say more than hostile, threatening to a free press in this country. Watching this is breathtaking and appalling. Now, there are those who say once he's inaugurated and his people are in place, this may change. I hope they're right, but there certainly is no evidence to suggest that that's what's going to happen after January 20th.
Should the other reporters have responded in some way, or how would you think that should have been handled?
That's an interesting question. And actually, the CNN reporter who was there indicated afterwards that the next question from an ABC reporter, the ABC reporter apparently picked up the question that he was trying to ask. So in that sense, there was a little bit of cooperation. But you got to wonder how much of a chilling effect this has on the media as they're in these situations. This president-elect has banned news organizations from his events through the course of the election. I think that there's a certain concern on the part of news organizations if that could happen again. How does one sort of take that on and deal with it? I also wonder if there wasn't a certain amount of disbelief in that exchange among the rest of the people in the media. I think the third factor in this is that obviously CNN had broken this story, and there is that that underlying competition among news organizations, and maybe others were thinking, well, finally we'll get our chance. But I think there are a number of reasons why it was difficult and unlikely that other members of the representative media would stand up and take on Trump in that situation. He was very much in control. This is the other thing. I mean, he didn't show any rustiness after 6 months hiatus in doing doing press conferences. Mm-hmm. He came out, he was in control, and I think being in that room, that has an impact on how you approach him and the questions you ask.
I'd like to hear just some of your brief thoughts about the multiple confirmation hearings that we've been subjected to this past week.
The Tillerson one was interesting in many ways. I think partly because this is a guy who's no political experience but has traveled the world as a businessman with ExxonMobil for a very long time. And I think the most interesting exchange was between him and Senator Marco Rubio, mm-hmm. who really took him on questions of human rights. And Tillerson was studious in not acknowledging bad actors in the area of human rights in the face of Rubio's questions. Rubio actually came back later and tried to clarify some of those answers, and I think left very displeased with the results. Is this the result of what Tillerson believes? Is this the result of what Tillerson was told he should say by his handlers, which is probably the case? Was it the right approach for him in this group? We shall see. I think he'll probably be confirmed, but I think that someone's going to have to do a lot of work with, at least with Marco Rubio, to get a yes vote out of him. And I think that the same can be said for the others. Mm-hmm. There is, I'm not sure, but I think the approach seems to be even more than usual, don't say anything because we really don't know where this president is on mm-hmm. these issues. And I think that really points to one of the most fascinating aspects of where we are mm-hmm. right now, in that I think that transition staff, soon to be White House staff, I think Republican leadership in the House and Senate, and individual members, and probably even men and women who are thinking about running as Republicans in 2018, are sort of trying to figure out behind the scenes, where is all of this going to go? And I don't think we have any clarity on that yet. In fact, that's the word that Rubio kept using mm-hmm. With his second round of questions. I need some clarity. Who is this guy? What does he really believe? And now that there is some evidence that the Russians have some dirt on him, will he suddenly turn against the Russians, as he has done back and forth with other political players, James Comey being one of them, over the course of the election cycle? I don't know.
Are you going to keep your eye on this whole situation and try to figure out what's going on as we move through it, or are you going to spend the next few years on a tropical island somewhere?
I will tell you this. I am spending inauguration weekend at the beach. Several of us have decided we really don't even want to be in this city for this event. Once that's over, I expect to be involved. I'm looking at engagement in a couple of organizations that I think can have a positive impact on where we go. They really address the issue that again, President Obama was talking about engagement, about staying engaged, speaking up, keeping an eye on things, and making our wills known. And I'm going to be looking at a couple of things like that. I've told people as I approach my retirement, I don't own a fishing rod and I don't play golf. So I've got to find something to do. And I think it will be some of my time devoted to sort of helping or encouraging Americans to seriously look at issues and try to come to a better understanding of what the implications of these things can be for us as a nation.
Greg LaBelle is an expert observer of American politics and culture. He's just retired as assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, though I'm glad to know he's going to be doing some teaching there still. Greg has also worked inside several presidential campaigns. Greg, I want you to enjoy your new freedom. Thanks so much for giving us part of your time today on State of Belief. You've always been generous. And we'll continue to turn to you for the wisdom that you have. Thank you.
Thanks, Welton.